Now we're joined on the line by our guest today from Fish and Game, Dave Clee. Can you hear me right, Dave?
Yeah, I can hear you. Loud and clear, mate.
Excellent. And how you be today, Dave?
Yeah, good, good. Looking forward to getting out of the office, mate, and looking at some wetlands. Just about to shoot off. And, we do a lot of wetland restoration work with keen landowners. So it's the fun part of the job, mate, getting to, never growing up, really. So love playing with diggers and bulldozers and building wetlands. So, yeah.
Right on. And where you got to go today?
So actually, the local guy not far from Raglan, who's got a bit of purchased a property, and he's got a few swampy areas and so on that he'd like to restore to wetland. As has been the case with many of agricultural landscapes in the past, we've sort of drained all our wetlands because they were viewed as a bit of a wasteland, and now people are seeing the value and putting them back in. So yeah, if we can help achieve that and maybe help get a bit of funding to, do some works and plant them up and make them all look pretty, and also obviously create habitat for birds. Happy days.
Yeah, well, what did I hear? Was it something like there's only 20% of the kind of wetlands left? Is that in the Waikato or in New Zealand or something like that?
Oh, mate, that's wishful thinking.
Oh, true.
less than 10% in New Zealand, and in the Waikato, it's less than that even. And we still, I mean, the problem is we're still losing them, and just if you look at all the functions that wetlands provide in terms of whether it be, they're called kidneys of the landscape because they have both a polishing effect in terms of water quality, but also in terms of water storage and so on. We've kind of worked under this paradigm of getting rid of water as quickly as we can, but a lot of the time that leads to downstream problems in terms of flooding and so on. And what we're starting to recognise, and hopefully we're starting to recognise, is that if we actually create areas where water can sit within catchments, A, it'll help water quality, but it'll also mean that all that water isn't, heading downstream all at once, and then we have, issues with stop banks being breached and flooding occurring and so on. So, there's a multitude of reasons why wetlands are important, not the least of which is obviously to provide our valued game birds somewhere to live and for our hunters to be able to go out and recreate and hopefully harvest a few.
Yeah, for sure. And do I remember hearing a story, a couple of native species, what is it, Kuta and Kununga, which you'll probably be familiar with. They actually draw heavy metals, they're wetland plants, and they draw heavy metals up out of the water as well. You heard that one?
Yeah, so, basically a lot of wetland plants will actually act as a filtration mechanism, right? And so a lot of the time they'll take a lot of sediment out of the water column. Some of them can uptake heavy metals, and also obviously, so for example, a lot of the time phosphorus is bound to sediment, and so if you can take the sediment out, you can reduce the amount of phosphorus in your waterways, and phosphorus is one of the nutrients which is responsible for things like algal growth and so on. So again, multiple benefits, I guess.
And if, I guess if folks have missed it, a very sort of sad reminder of that was what's happened over at Lake Whangamarino in the Waikato. Tell us a bit about that one, Dave.
Yeah, so obviously the summer, mate, we had, as everyone knows, we had a different summer. Not our normal drought that we normally seem to have every year. And so what happened is we had these unseasonable rainfall events, and again, with our water all getting into this wetland all at once, and obviously the water quality as well coming in is very poor out of some of those catchments. Massive organic load coming in, and it caused parts of that wetland to go anoxic, so that's without oxygen for up to 3 months in places, and obviously when you've got no oxygen in the water, it tends to kill everything. And so we had these big fish kills, tens of tons of dead fish. Now, some of those fish are obviously exotic species like koi carp. We're not too worried about getting rid of them. But there's also eels, and basically anything with gills can't live without oxygen. And then what happens is that causes a bit of a cascade of effects, because we then had a botulism outbreak, which often follows a fish kill or invertebrate kill, because it provides a protein source for the botulism bacteria to provide spores that gets uptaken by the bird life. And then, bang, we have this big epizootic botulism outbreak. So, yeah, mate, I got to spend a fair bit of my summer cruising around in the wetland and picking up dead and decaying birds. You got to try and remove as many as you can out of the wetland, otherwise the whole thing actually can go exponential through the carcass maggot cycle. So each maggot that a carcass holds can hold enough toxin to kill another bird.
Gee whiz.
And if you've ever had chickens in your life, you know that birds are quite partial to eating the odd maggot here and there. And so then, yeah, the whole thing can sort of just accumulate into this snowball effect, if you will. So, yeah, and you know, a lot of people helped out, especially all our hunters that, you know, went out there in their summertime when I'm sure they would have been much happier going snapper fishing and picking up dead and decaying stuff. Not a fun job, and, yeah, certainly a few things that, yeah, when you pick up one of those three-week-old shags, that's well and truly on the way to decomposing. It's make you lose your breakfast pretty quickly, so definitely appreciate all the help that hunters gave us, that's for sure.
Yeah, no doubt. Yeah, no, I saw the article just this morning that you alerted me to in The Guardian of all publications, and, yeah, I mean, it wasn't like, what was it, like Wairere, was it?
Lake Waikare, yeah.
Waitere, yeah. It was basically like, you know, yellow, and they called it, the locals call it the Fanta Lake, because and that's an algae bloom thing, isn't it?
Yeah, so it goes through different colorations. So it gets blue-green, cyanobacterial blooms, and then it goes through this, yeah, terracotta orange phase with a different type of algae that blooms. So, yeah, look, it's a really degraded lake. It's one of the most polluted lakes in the Southern Hemisphere. You know, and unfortunately, once our lakes collapse to that magnitude, it's really, really difficult to restore them. In fact, I'm not aware of any example where a lake that's gone, that's flipped into that kind of state, has ever been restored anywhere in the world. So, and yeah, so that, you know, that whole system there has got some huge challenges facing it, and unfortunately no quick fixes. And yeah, so, you know, I guess the other thing is, you know, we're currently working on a whole lot of different areas, but a lot of our other lakes are still declining as well. So from my perspective, ensuring that those remaining lakes that are still in good quality at the moment, making sure they don't turn into another Lake Waikare is really important, because like I say, once they do turn and flip into these algal dominated states, we don't really know how to bring them back, you know. So yeah, it's you know, as you know, if you follow the media or anything really, the water quality in New Zealand, Aotearoa, is something that's a quite hot topic, and and I think, you know, I guess my key message is that we all need to do better when it comes to water quality and trying to improve.
Oh, for sure, and I know farmers have got a big hand, or some farmers anyway, with the runoffs, right, coming out off nutrient runoff off farms and things like that. But I think it was Waikare. I think there's a lot of human waste runs out of there too. Is there not?
So look, there's a wastewater treatment plant that discharges into the lake. You know, we've been campaigning for a long time to get that discharge removed from that lake, and there is a process currently, a short-term consent process, which is supposed to be achieving that. Now, let's hope it's almost time for that consent to come up, and that's what we'll be holding the council to account to ensure that they do remove that treated wastewater out of that lake. And it has been operating in a non-compliant manner for some time as well. So again, like I said, we all need to improve. Having said that, the nutrient load and sediment load and even fecal coliform load coming out of that wastewater treatment plant is only a very small portion of the total catchment load coming in there. Mm-hmm. It's less than 5%. So depending on which estimates you use, but it's not a large portion of the total load. So again, I think, you know, the message is, well, I think we all need to improve, whether that's factories, whether it's towns and individuals, that we can make improvements in how we use and treat water, and obviously the agricultural sector, we all need to make improvements, otherwise our lakes will continue to collapse and we will continue to see issues like what's happening in Whangamurino this summer.
Yeah, it's a tricky one, but there's got to be a solution out there somewhere. I have read there's some promising research being done on having fungal kind of sandbags. You followed that one at all?
Can't say that specific one. I mean, look, we've had all sorts of potential remedies proposed. I guess my, again, I mean, this is sort of my background as a freshwater ecologist, and in most cases, if it sounds too good to be true, it usually is. having said that, I mean, if there are innovative solutions, by all means, but what it really comes back down to is trying to, you know, and again, I keep harping on about it, but if we could get more wetlands put in, you know, large-scale wetlands that would help treat runoff before exiting catchments into sensitive receiving environments, those type of mitigations would be really helpful. But also just looking at, you know, critical source areas on land. And then, hey, look, there's some really good research that's come out that has shown that, for example, looking at farm systems and stocking rates and so on, and, you know, there's some innovative landowners out there that have actually lowered the overall inputs, the overall production, but they've become more profitable by doing so because they're farming more within the limits of the soil and what, you know, the natural landscape provides for them, rather than relying heavily on, you know, importing feed and external nitrogen and so on. So I think there are ways we can improve. It's not going to suit everyone all the time, but I think we need to keep looking at that, eh? And like I say, if we can make improvements across the board, you know, and that includes everyone, then I think that's the direction we need to head.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's a work together thing. It's not a stand around and like blame each other thing like people tend to do these days. But it's more like, you know, let's get it all together, everybody, and see what we can do kind of situation. Would probably work best, wouldn't it, Dave?
Yeah, look, and I think, you know, we will have to make some sacrifices, though, you know, and that's always the hard part, eh, is when we start talking about, you know, retiring areas and restoring wetlands. I understand it, man. There's pressures, financial pressures people are under, you know. And, yeah, it's a difficult thing when you've got, you know, a massive mortgage that you're trying to service and you're trying to manage those competing interests. So, you know, but in all honesty, those are, you know, we are going to have to, all as individuals, make some sacrifices and start putting water quality and the environment first. Otherwise, you know, personally, all of the main metrics at the moment are still, most of them aren't trending in a positive direction, you know, when it comes to those issues. Anyway, that's some of the big picture environmental stuff.
Right. Yeah. All right. But I was just on a farm the other day when I was running around doing my census work, where there's a beautiful big lake, a guy you work with, up just south of Nike Ways, and I think, yeah, he was saying that I think you guys helped him out, you know, with some funding and things like that. So I guess, you know, if you're a bloke with, or a person with a bit of land or something like that, and you've got a wetland there, what do you do?
Yeah, classic point in case, that one, you know. I mean, you're talking about a boggy paddock, essentially, that, you know, historically someone decided to stick a drain through it. It was never very productive. Might provide a little bit of summer grazing, but that was probably offset by the fact that you lose a few cattle in it every year when they got stuck in the winter. So, you know, those type of areas, as you saw, you know, beautiful 5-6 hectare wetland now, holding a whole lot of bird life, providing a habitat for both, you know, game birds, but also indigenous and threatened species. So look, if these landowners are keen, all they need to do is give us a shout here at the office at Auckland Waikato Fish and Game, and we can look at how we can assist. You know, we don't have any, I mean, we're solely licensed, power funded, right? So we don't get any external, there's a misconception that we're a government department. We do report to the minister, but we don't actually get any government funding, right? So the only way we get funding is if someone buys a trout fishing license or game bird hunting license. So not a lot of fat in our budget, but what we can do is help with funding applications. And so I've just lodged another 2 big funding applications with local landowners. One's a 17 hectare wetland and the other one's a 5 hectare wetland. You know, and we're applying for, in some cases, up to $300,000-$400,000 to try and get those projects up and, you know, and get them implemented. So that's sort of our key area, is we can look at different opportunities and funding sources we could look to tap into. And, yeah, if there's people that are keen to get good outcomes environmentally on their properties, then we're keen to help out.
And I know the council chips in for some plants and some fencing and things like that. Does anybody else generally do that? Like, does Doc chip in with this sorts of things or not really?
If it's on Doc land, Doc tend to focus on that rather than private. council definitely come to the party. So we'll often, what we'll try and do, that's sort of what we do with these zoning applications, is we'll try and connect all the relevant dots, you know. So we'll get together, we'll look at a site, we'll say, hey, here, this is a cool project, let's put together a three-year plan or a five-year plan, because a lot of these funding applications obviously take some time to get them, submit them, get the returns, you know, and then you look at leveraging off that. So you try to, you know, see what the landowner can contribute, see what, like, the regional council can contribute, and then you leverage off all of that to try and, you know, boost your funding from other sources. And there's, you know, there's three or four funds currently set up in the Waikato where, you know, we can get some money from most of the time if it's a good project.
Nice.
Yeah, and so there are other agencies that can come on board, and we try and connect all those people together, basically.
Yeah, all right. I was just thinking to myself just then, I interviewed Bixi, who's I think she's running the, or managing or something like that, or coordinating at least the Mangatauteri to Porongia sort of
corridor. Yep.
Corridor, yeah. You guys involved with that one?
So we're aware of it, and we've been involved in it. We don't have integral involvement. I can't claim any of the credit for that one. So, those are exactly the type of things that we can get involved in. Obviously, our main focus is obviously on wetlands, because that's where our, you know, species, our game birds and so on tend to live, and also any sort of trout fishing waters, which again is in line with our statutory functions, you know, and providing habitat for trout and angler access and all those kind of things. So,
Just on trout, how's the populations holding up at the moment?
Yeah, well, we're pretty lucky, eh? We avoided the worst of the carnage, obviously, up here with flooding and so on. As you can imagine, if you get these massive big floods that come through with massive sediment loads, it can really knock the population back. My colleague Adam's been out doing some drift dive post-cyclone events, and he generally seen pretty good numbers in most of our waterways. I think the one thing that probably threatens our trout populations most moving forward is the increasing hot temperatures that we're seeing over summer. Trout really sensitive to temperature change, and basically once you get 19 degrees or above, a lot of the waterways become unsuitable for trout. So
right,
we're seeing that a lot of them, some of our smaller rivers and so on, especially when there isn't much shade on them, they can really heat up during summer, and yeah, it really limits the amount of habitat available for trout in some of them. So, if we get another degree or two warmer than what we currently are, then that will definitely be problematic for trout, and especially the North Waikato areas like that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yet again, another good reason to fence off your streams and plant some trees over them to offer a bit of shade.
Exactly.
That,
shade trees. Look, shade can reduce water temperatures by up to 4 degrees.
Gee,
you know, so, like, yeah, that makes a massive difference to water temp. So, yeah, for sure, like, yeah, having some good overhead cover and trees makes it a bit harder to catch a fish because you can't catch your line out. But
true.
At least there's fish in there.
I didn't think about that one, but you leave some little clear patches here and there for the old pool or two.
Exactly. Maybe leave your favourite fishing hole without big tall trees around, but yeah, plant up the rest to try and keep those temperatures down.
All right, the trout numbers are pretty good. That's good. And of course, you know, it's May pretty soon. So it's going to be the opening weekend for the duck season. How's the duck numbers stacking up?
Yeah, well, we had a great spring and summer in terms of, for most areas. Obviously, the Whangarei is a bit of an exception to that rule with the botulism outbreak that we had there and the mortalities that we had. But in general, look, I mean, there's still birds nesting at the moment, which is pretty crazy to say. So in New Zealand in particular, the constraint on reproduction of our birds, it tends to be more condition-focused in terms of, you know, the hen condition in particular. So if there's a lot of protein around, especially leading into the breeding season, the birds can put on a lot of lipid fat reserves, which then stimulate egg production, and the breeding season can extend out quite significantly. And, you know, birds will have try to have up to 4 clutches in a season.
Right.
So that is a benefit, I guess, in dry years where it's drought-stricken, you know, leading into summer. That has a really negative consequence on those birds because they're not there's no insect life because the swamps are all dry and the wetlands are dry and there's no puddles around.
Yeah.
So, you know, and if, I don't know, if you've had chickens and you just try and feed them maize, for example, they go off the lay pretty quickly. Mm. Same for ducks, you know, if they're just feeding on cereal crops or if they're feeding on maize or whatever, then they're not going to do too well in terms of getting all the right nutrition to, you know, produce a lot of ducklings and raise those ducklings. So, yeah, so, look, it's been good. We've got a few ducks around. Most people should find it pretty good. The only other, I guess, the disadvantage of having a lot of water around is that the birds have got lots of options. You know, you'll find little pockets of birds sort of hiding out in little nooks and crannies all over the place, especially after opening weekend, because there'll be a lot of little safe havens for them.
Mm.
Personally, I don't mind that. The longer I stay in this job, the more, and I realise just how susceptible ducks are to things like predation and so on. The more I start rooting for the ducks to survive and make it through, you know. The shooters want to get some, but if we can get more to survive, then hopefully that means a better season the following year, you know. And especially, I guess, my message to hunters out there is, if there's one thing you can do in terms of helping the duck population, is just try not to shoot the hens. If you can, you know, we've got way more drakes in our population than hens, and hens have got a lower survival rate because, as you can imagine, when you're sitting on a nest, you're highly susceptible to getting snaffled by a cat or a ferret or a stoat. So we've got a lot of males, a lot of dudes, and as you know, when it comes to a reproductive success, us guys seem to be relatively surplus to requirements, at least when there's too many. So if we take out a few more of the dudes and leave more of the hens to breed, then that'll be perfect. So, yeah.
That's very sound advice. And so... You know, the basics are right. You get a license, right, through Fish and Game.
Yeah, by license you can get them online, mate. Later in the season, you get a day license. There's also, we've got this thing called Take Your Mate Hunting. So if you've never been duck shooting before, but you got some mates that go duck shooting, and you want to give it a crack, you can get yourself a license for opening weekend. It's only $5, or even $4, maybe. Sure. And you can go out with your mates and see if it's something that you might want to get into. So that's only available for those people that haven't been out before. It's a sort of first-timer sort of thing, you know, people that want to go out and give it a crack. So,
yeah,
if you're in that boat, give the office a call and we'll sort you out with a Take Your Mate Hunting license. And then, you'll get a little regulations book. Have a look. There's a few new regs that have come in this year, and particularly there's some drift shooting regulations on the Waikato River where, you know, people have built flash new subdivisions or, you know, there's a cycle trail that runs right along it now. So, regrettably, we've had to put some restrictions in to try and prevent anyone from getting hurt or injured. Just getting unsafe down there, basically, to discharge firearms right next to the cycle trail. Have a look at the regs and make sure you know what the changes are. And if you've got any questions, obviously, feel free to give the office a call and we can run you through them.
Yeah. And what's the length of the season this year, Dave?
So the main dabbling duck season runs for 4 weeks. So that's your, that is for your shoveler, mallard, grey duck, and swan as well. They fall into that dabbling duck season. And then your paradise shell duck go for 2 months. So, and then you got all your upland game, your pheasants and quail and so on, that goes for 4 months.
Okay.
And pukekos as well, they go for 4 months as well. So,
I didn't realise it's a thing for shooting pukekos.
Yeah, you can shoot pukekos. They're actually not bad eating, mate. There's this old bloody wild sale that, you know, if you shoot a pukeko, you bore the pukeko next to a gumboot and then you throw the pukeko away and eat the gumboot. But if you breast out the pukeko meat and eat it, it's actually quite light coloured. It's not as gamey as duck. And I hope you have, I've yet to cook some pukeko breast for someone who hasn't liked it. So, give it a shot, mate. And obviously, in some places, pukekos are definitely, especially in and around city areas, the numbers are increasing and they're getting quite high. And they can be, if they get really high, they can be quite destructive in terms of pulling out, especially if you're doing restoration projects and so on, pulling out young plants and or they actually kill other chicks and nests as well. yeah, they're quite territorial in that regard. So,
yeah.
Like everything, mate, they're a native bird. We don't want to, you know, we don't want to take out too many, but it's a balancing act. And, you know, we have obviously, same with paradise ducks, we have influenced their populations by changing the landscape. And paradise ducks and pukekas are probably the only two native birds that have benefited from the way that we manage our land nowadays. So, yeah, it's all about, you know, facilitating some harvest and allowing people to shoot some, but maintaining a good population.
Yeah, no, I can't remember there ever been a, you know, I'm seeing a shortage of pukekas around there. Like I say, they just seem to be more and more than anything else. But, yeah, yep. Speaking of more and more, man, like the Canadian geese thing, I know it's been kicked around like... And no one seems to be taking responsibility for, you know, because the numbers are growing exponentially, I understand. And so where's kind of that at as far as, you know, is it going to be a central government thing or a regional council or a district council thing? Is there any sort of movement in those ways?
Yeah, it's a good question, mate. I'd love to give you an answer. I mean, obviously, they were a game bird up to 2011. They were removed as a game bird at the time. I mean, there's press releases coming out saying, yep, you know, essentially, you know, Fish and Game weren't doing a good enough job, and now we're going to manage them, and that was from the likes of Federated Farmers. To be honest, I haven't seen too much coherent management since they were removed from a game bird status. We still monitor the numbers just because we monitor them the same time as we do our swan flights, so we still count the geese as well. Last year was the first year in a while that we actually saw a little reduction in goose numbers, so...
Yeah, yeah.
I guess in lieu of any, you know, real coherent management from any of the institutions you have raised, there are some local individual landowners and so on who are taking it upon themselves, and some of them have found techniques and ways, whether it's molt culls or organising hunters, including helicopters and so on, to manage local goose problems. We might not have been doing a perfect job, Fish and Game, but I think having some form of coherent management for any species that's highly adaptable and smart is important, and I'm not seeing anything happening at the moment. Who the agency is that should be doing that, who knows? I mean, you know, I'd say we'll do it again, but to be honest, with the numbers being so high now, I don't think we'd want to take it on without some, you know, financial backing to reduce the numbers back down to more manageable levels. I sort of shake my head a bit because I don't really get what the strategy was, you know, like, you know, you imagine if you said, TB Free New Zealand are going to stop doing possum control and we're just going to rely on individuals to do it. Can you imagine that working? You know, I can't. People are busy, man. Shooting big numbers of geese is there are ways you can do it, but it takes time and effort and money. So I don't really get how anyone ever thought that just removing them as a game bird and leaving it up to people to sort out their own problems is ever going to be a good strategy, you know, to manage a population.
Yeah, it doesn't sound too smart, all right. And I know just even here in the harbour, right, you know, because there's so many of them, if they all go and cruise around in big gangs, right, and all the nutrient and that from, you know, when they poo in the water and things like that, and they clean out all the, you know, the seagrass and stuff as well, don't they? So it's pretty detrimental, really, you know.
Yeah, look, if the numbers get too high, again, if I look at things like nutrient inputs, all the data that we've got, even on in lakes and so on, relatively minuscule compared to external loads from other sources.
Yeah.
You know, like even in a lake like Rotuahu down in Rotorua, which has got really high numbers of geese and swan. It's, you know, it's like less than 2%. So, so again, I don't think they're the main contributor, but in terms of sort of changing, and again, they're more pasture feeders as well rather than eating a lot of eelgrass and so on, but they can definitely, I've seen them browsing on zostra beds and so on. So again, man, everything needs to be balanced, eh? And I think we've, with geese, we've kind of, yeah, we dropped the ball a little bit there.
Yeah, interesting. Oh, well, yeah, hopefully someone listening takes it up, Dave. Well, will they do? I don't know, man, but yeah.
Yeah, look, I mean, the hunters, obviously, the individual hunters out there that I know that shoot 2,000-3,000 geese in a year, you know, and they do it really well. And look, that, for them, they're a valued resource, and I actually love shooting geeks. I don't have much time anymore since I had a couple of kids to do all the necessary work and scouting and so on, and it's quite gear-intensive, but they can be awesome fun to shoot, you know, like if you get in the right spot with the right setup and have a, you know, day where you shoot a couple hundred geese, it's a lot of fun, and they are actually really tasty as well. That's the other thing, is you can, you know, I will often convert them into salamis or goose pastrami is really good, and even just, you know, plucked and eaten, roasted, really good. So, again, like the young birds, not, you don't want to be eating a 20-year-old gander, I don't think that's going to taste any good, but... But, yeah, so, look, they can be a resource. It's just, again, we need to manage them within sustainable environmental limits, you know. Don't let them get out of hand.
Yeah, yeah. Wise words, Dave. And where are you going to be opening weekend?
Oh, mate, we'll be everywhere and anywhere. So. Make sure you got your license. We will be out and about doing our patrols. And you know what I always hear? From people, when we, you know, get out the back of some farm at the back in the middle of nowhere and check a license or two, the one word I always hear is, never expected to see you here. So we'll keep it that way. and just, yeah, make sure you know your rules, make sure you got a license, and everything will be sweet. So that's the main take-home message, yeah, is, you know, we're just out there doing our jobs. We don't want to have any trouble, we don't want to get anyone else into trouble, but in order to make that happen, just follow the rules, you know, and everything will be all good on the day.
Yeah, be safe and all that. And you're still looking for are you looking for volunteers at all to help out with that, or?
Oh, yep, not so much. Well, I think our rangers are all pretty much fully sorted at the moment, and there's quite a process, as you can imagine, when you're, you know, dealing with going and talking to people with firearms in their hands and their possessions, that you need to go through a fair bit of training, you know, before you get accredited to be able to do that. So I think we're pretty much maxed out at the moment. But look, if there's people out there that are passionate and want to contribute in any way, shape or form, hey, you know, whether it's turning up at a planting day or doing some wetland work or whatever, yep, always keen to talk to anyone who's keen to get good outcomes. So, yeah, they can contact me.
Right on. And they do that, I guess, fish and game email, something like that?
Yeah, or just contact the office, 07849-166. That's the Auckland Waikato Fish and Game office.
Yeah.
If I'm not out and about in a wetland somewhere, I'll usually be here. So, yeah, give us a shout. Oh, the other thing is, tomorrow night, hunting and fishing has got a duck night on. I'll be talking at that, and there's some pretty cool prizes you can win. There's a duck calling comp, all sorts of stuff. So, that's the hunting and fishing down here, Waikato. So people can turn up to that.
Where's that one going to be?
Down here in Tarapa. Waikato hunting and fishing,
Sweet.
Yeah, they do it every year, mate. And there's some pretty cool prizes, actually. And most of the time, if you turn up, you'll win yourself a spot prize of some description. And I think last year, the main prize was like a $600 jacket that someone walked away with. So, yeah.
Sweet. Yeah. All right. Now, well, that's good. Well, good luck with that, mate. And we'll maybe see you around over the season, David. And thanks very much for coming on the show. Really appreciate your time, mate. We'll keep in touch about things as time goes by.
Yeah, no worries, mate. Anytime, mate.
Yeah, cheers, man. Appreciate it.
All right. Cheers. All right. Have a good one.
Have a good one. Yeah, you too, mate.
All right.
See you,
thanks.
Mate.
Bye.
See ya.